Hey team, it's Coach Conway with Dennis Heeman coming at us from Southern California. He's one of our regionals down there, and we're gonna have a conversation. I don't even like to call this an interview, but we're gonna have a conversation today to get to know a little bit more about Dennis. So you're telling me it's a nice warm day in Southern Cali this morning.
Yeah, beautiful this morning, and I'm glad it's not an interview. I already have probably one job too many, and I don't want to lose the one I have. So I'll just shoot from the hip if that's okay, Wade.
Yeah, that sounds cool. So what's a normal day look like? So what's today? What else you got going on in the agenda today?
Yeah, so for me, a normal day, I start my day first of all by going through the numbers. I spend probably half hour, 45 minutes in the morning, just kind of looking through all the numbers, not only within the region, but the company, individuals within my region. And then I look at trends as well. So what's going on in the market? What's the 10-year doing? What's mortgage backs doing right now? Kind of getting a flavor of what's going on. And today we've got, I counted yesterday, I think it's like 13 different indicators that are coming out, some very small, some larger. It's going to be a very volatile day on the market. So I'm kind of watching to see just how bumpy it is. And for me, I try not to manage day to day because you can get kind of psychotically crazy watching this market, especially right now. But I want to be there for my people and make sure they know the trends that are coming. And, you know, I get asked all the time, you know, hey, boss, should I lock it? Should I float? You know, and I said, hey, if Barry Habib's having trouble during these times, don't look at me for the crystal ball. When in doubt, always lock. And that's what I always tell them. So, but I want to be in the know as much as I can so we can have intelligent conversations.
Cool. And I know that you work out a lot. So is that part of a daily routine, or is that you have a Monday, Wednesday, Friday routine, or what do you do there?
It's a daily routine. Everything I do, from my structure in the morning to, you know, all throughout the day, has its, you know, like its place within in my schedule of my day. And so I will work till about 5:30, 6 o'clock, and then I go work out for about an hour and a half every single night. I will answer a few emails in between sets or whatever I'm doing. And then I come back. I usually will finish off any, you know, emergency emails or stuff I need to do before dinner, and then I'll have dinner. And then it's from that point on, it's I shut out the world just a little bit. I do about an hour worth of social media every night. And so after I have dinner, after my workout, I have dinner, then I hit social media, and a lot of that is I've got recruiting within my social media. And this is just, you know, building relationships, learning about people. I don't look at it as recruiting. I look at it as a relationship, just like I would with my friends. So I'm in there seeing what's going on with their lives, commenting, learning. You learn a lot on social media, good, bad, and indifferent, somewhere in between all the Super Bowl hype and everything that we've been reading about Kansas City. I also find out some good information in between. So
So is that kind of the discipline and the structure like that? That's something that's always been part of you, or is there something that is there a time when you could think of that wasn't really something that you did?
was not always a part of me. So when I started in the business, I was 20 years old, just out of college. I was your prototypical salesperson. Boom, 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 boom. No structure. Deals half-baked. Trying to get stuff to the finish line, getting stuff to underwriters. And they would be, whoa, whoa, what is going on? Right. So it kind of started maybe in my mid-20s. I started to get a little bit more structure, mostly around loans and deals, so that I was submitting good packages. And then when I moved into management, I found that I didn't have enough time in my day to originate and help train people. So I had to get structured at that point. And so it's been an evolution. And so now at, you know, almost 57 years old, my day is very structured. I spend either 1 or 2 hours recruiting every day. It's literally outlooked. I almost feel like I have bathroom breaks in my outlook just to make sure that everything flows properly. And what it does for me, which I found is really a great benefit, is it alleviates my stress, helps me prioritize, And, it helps me be more effective. And
Yeah.
then my people know what to expect out of me too. They know at this time I'm doing this, at this time I'm doing that. You know, when to get a hold of me, it alleviates their stress too, because I'm very, very involved in my operation. I managed the US for about 25 years. So I was on a plane running around. Now, as a regional, the last 7, 8 years of my career, I'm able to be a lot deeper, a lot more deep immersed into my operation. And I love that. Get involved with deals, get involved with mentoring, coaching at a whole different level. So I got to have time for all that.
So raising kids and coaching LOs, you got any comparison contrast from those?
Ha! Kids are easier. Less ego, more willing to be mentored at times, right? But yeah, here's what I know are things are similar, because I use this analogy all the time. So, when raising my kid, I was a single father, and raising my kid, my ex had moved out of state, and he stayed with me. And so I learned a lot of lessons. One of the things that was always interesting was my kid would be how he acted at home. But when you go over to a neighbor's house, and they would be doing whatever it is that they would be doing, I would get the feedback from the neighbor. Oh my God, your kid is so amazing. He's so well-behaved. He's so this, he's so that. And I'm like, how is that? He's not that way at my house. And then with LOs, it's the same. I'll hear from like managers or market leaders that I'll do some training, and they will immediately start using what I show them. And then I'll hear the manager or the market leader say, I've showed them that 5 times and they've never once done it. And you show them like in 10 minutes, it's that effect. Sometimes it really takes, a village, a tribe to all come together and reach you. And I think that's what's so great about coaching and mentoring is if you've got more people involved, sometimes you just hear it at the right time from the right person and it clicks with you. So I think that is something that I see is I see those parallels always from raising a kid. And then, you always have to keep the human equation, right? No matter how well planned out your world is, it doesn't always go as you would like it to. And I always tell people there's probably 10 ways to skin a cat, maybe more than that. But the one that will work is the one that people believe in. And as leaders, many times, because this is my 36th year of lending, many times you think, wow, I know how to fix that. I know how to do that. And you just want to take your people and lead them through. But the problem is, it may not be what they believe in. It may not be what they're passionate or what they see as the true solution. And there's usually 4 or 5 ways to do anything, sometimes more. And if you do it the way that people believe and get buy-in with, it's probably going to be more successful than what you may know is the path to getting it done. So
sounds like you've had some coaching experience, because that's exactly what I found from coaching.
A ton. Yeah. I somebody asked me, how many people have you managed over your years? And I think I'm encroaching about 20,000 salespeople over the course of 36 years. I've had some big companies I've overseen, and it's the times are different, but people are very similar. No two are alike, but how you approach people and how you win as a leader and be a support mechanism, those things have stayed true throughout the years. And really different industries. I have friends in all kinds of different industries who are leaders, and they face the same challenges. It's the human element.
Yeah.
And if you remember, you're dealing with human beings, and you try and be a good human being yourself. Listen more when you speak, have a little bit of humility, learn every day. Those things will take you a long way as a leader.
I love that. So this is the Never Settle for Par podcast. So I've got to do things in fours. So I've got something to take us off on a tangent. I've done a few of these before, and it's easy for a couple of mortgage guys. I've been doing this for 20 years and you for 36 to get together and talk shop about the mortgage business. But I want to know a little bit about you as well. So how about 4 things that you really, really want to do in life?
So I don't know if these are in any particular order, right? But I want to travel in every state in the United States. I've been in most of them, maybe 2 or 3, but But when I say travel to them, go there, really learn what's going on there, meet the people. We have like 50 different countries in the U.S. You know, if you go to Texas, or, you know, you're up in the Northeast, or you're in Washington, and heavens knows for sure, California, you're like in different countries. And one of my goals is to do to be able to travel to a state. And when I retire, which I'm retiring at 67, I have a very specific plan for that. When I retire, we're going to travel every month. I talked to my financial advisor about our plan to do that. And then second thing I want to do is travel outside the U.S. every quarter. So four times a year. If it ends up being three times, just, you know, from just logistics, that's okay. But I want to at least have it be that many times so that I can see the world before I leave this world. And it seems like every time I travel outside, I learn more and more. So those two things, both travel related. And then I want to do something that I want to be able to give back in some capacity. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's, you know, spending time with charities. I don't know if that's just mentoring youth. I love youth. I believe youth is the key to changing things. I have managed adults for a long time. It is really hard to change that equation. So I would like to spend, you know, some more time doing that. And then ultimately the last one, I can't wait to see, you know, my family expand. My son, I have a longtime girlfriend, her son, who I'm now involved in parenting with, you know, those boys, my boy's grown, he's 30. Her son is 14, and just waiting for them to have kids and kind of being that next step, the grandparent. I think that's going to be an interesting evolution. So I look forward to that. So those are kind of the things I'm looking forward to.
I'll listen to a couple of podcasts myself, and I'll probably, if we get into that, we talk about that. But one of the guests was talking about what type of what's important in our life. We got these people get it wrong. They got things that they think it's 1x, 10x, 20x. They said lots of times it's like 1x, 10x, and like 1000x. It's like the really, really important things, like your relationships with your wife or your family, your kids, being a grandfather, you know, that father figure there, if you will. You know, I think those are the things that if you don't get right, looking back, when they interview people when they're on their deathbed, one of the interviews I heard about, that's the experience he and his wife had, is she got diagnosed with cancer. And in the last 6 months, they just really, really grew deeper, and just the ability to learn the important lessons in life like that. So I love that. That's great to share that.
Yeah, it's important to me. I've had death around me a lot. You know, I've had some friends now that, you know, I'm getting in my mid-late 50s. You start to have friends that lose family members or whatnot, parents, and you watch just how devastating that is, you know, when they lose somebody close to them for the first time in their life. And I've had that throughout my life. I've lost so many people around me at such early age that, you know, you start to value earlier. That, you know, life is short, it's fleeting. You got to take advantage and prioritize what's important, like you just said, right?
Yeah.
And certainly family, friends, for me, are a super important part. We entertain a lot. Yeah. During COVID, we built a 20 person bar in my backyard. the crazy so things that you do during COVID.
I gotta go check that out. I got to see that. That sounds like fun.
It's like a nightclub in my backyard. So all of our neighborhood, all of the partners that we do business with, we're in a constant state of entertaining at least twice a week, sometimes three times a week. So friends and having people around me is super important. And so those connections, like you said, it's what you should really value. And I'm trying to do that. The more older I get, the more I'm trying to do that.
How about four things that you're still doing that it's just like, it's absurd that I keep doing that? So maybe it's a quirk or a habit or just a little bit of looking underneath, you know.
I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can get to four, but I'm going to try. One of the things is in the gym, I still act like I'm, you know, 18 years old in the gym. So when you get me in there, if I'm there and there's, you know, a younger guy, and now you're starting to see, you know, a lot of powerlifting females in the gym as well, right? So there's a lot of strength all around me. And so as a 57-year-old guy, I'll see somebody maybe lifting 50 or 60-pound dumbbells, and I'll have to go just get 5 pounds more than they have, just to make sure they remember I may be the one of the older dudes in the gym, but I'm still going to school you just a little bit. Yeah, that's one thing. The other thing is I have an e-bike and I live down at the beach. And so e-biking is like a real thing. And you see mostly a lot of, 12 to 15 year olds like flying down the street on these e-bikes now. I'm one of them. So I'm the 57-year-old, 14-year-old flying down the street on an e-bike going 30 miles an hour. Awesome. I'm sure someday that is going to catch up to me. It has not yet. That's something else I still can't believe that I'm doing. And then something that I was doing that I haven't been doing as much is surfing. I figured that was something I would be continuing to do out into my later life. And what I found is, the older I get, the less tolerant I am to cold water. And it's very
cold. So you're not a fan of the cold water plunge that everybody's doing right now?
Nope. You get me to Hawaii or you get me out in the East Coast or down in the Caribbean, and I'll be in the water all day long. I could live on top of a surfer or a sailboard. But in California, just going, knee deep in the water, my knees are knocking. And so, no, you're not going to see me do a cold plunge. At all. In fact, as at my desk right now, you can't see it, but literally within 4 feet of where I'm standing right now is a very large heater blowing warm air on me. And it's almost 60 degrees outside. I'm in Southern California. So
four things that have had the most impact on you. These could be people, books, experiences. What's impacted you the most?
Yeah, I'm going to start with probably the largest impact. It's a funny story. I've told it before. So if anybody who knows me is watching this in the future, I apologize because you've heard this story before. But when I was 16, I was having a birthday party. And my mom, I had all my friends over. My mom threw a big birthday party for me. She invited everybody over. It was like a surprise, but not. And so everybody's over. And we're having a great time. And my mom takes and grabs me, pulls me over the corner of the room. And she has this look in her face like she's going to say something profound. And my mom's very smart. And so I'm ready. I'm leaning in, right? And she goes, look around this room. And what I thought she was going to say is, look at all these people here to celebrate your birthday with you. You should be so proud, right? That's not what she said. So she said, come over here. I came in the corner and she goes, look out all over here. She goes, in a room like this, you're probably not the smartest guy in the room. In fact, you're probably not in the top five or even maybe even the top 10. I'm like, wow, mom, where are you going? It's my 16th birthday. What are you saying to me? She goes, but within a room like this, there's always somebody smarter than you at something. And you will be always the most successful if you surround yourself with people that are smart at something and you step back and you allow them to be smart at what they're at. That will always make you look like the smartest guy in the room. And I was like, wow, that was probably, you want to talk about some of the most profound statements.
A big nugget for a 16-year-old, right?
Yeah. And you know what? I took it to heart. Obviously, I'm talking about it. God knows how many is it, like a half a century later. I'm talking about this. And so it was definitely a big influence. I think about that all the time. My father was a huge influence on me. He was a man who said very little. My mom is very very, you get her in a room, she'll meet everybody, know everybody in seconds. 4'11", spitfire. My dad, just the opposite, very quiet, very much a wallflower, very cerebral, super smart, electrical engineer, and the hardest working guy you'll ever imagine. He always put family first. He always made sure everybody, all the bills were paid, that everybody was taken care of way before him. In fact, my mom didn't buy stuff for him, like clothing. He wouldn't have bought anything. He was always everybody first. He was last in line, and he worked really, really hard and never asked for anything for it. That selflessness is something that I've never had to the extent that I wish I had it, but I am always reminded of it from my father. So I think that's something that I take and carry with me a lot. I also had a mentor, Steve Brown. Early in my career, I've had some mentors. The last couple of things I'll talk about will be my mentors. One, Steve Brown. They called him Downtown Steve Brown. We were rocking the mortgage world when we were all together. There was like four of us And it was just when household finance was kind of becoming a thing, and it was subprime mortgages before subprime mortgages even existed. It was a finance company,
right.
So these aren't government backed. These are self-generated mortgages, and he taught me just how to have fun, how to care about your people, how to put your people first, how to build a team, how important team is. And like, as a leader, I learned so much from him, on just how to get up every day and just enjoy this business. And I do, even in the roughest of years, and boy, 2023 was the roughest of years. You can ask the people I support, get up every day loving this job. Yeah. And I love them and I love the job. And he taught me about. And then the last thing I was getting promoted. This was a lot of years ago, but I was getting promoted to more of a senior level position. It was a director position, but I was quite young. I was 28, and it was going to be about 106 office locations. So I was young for that amount. And I was with the president of a company, and he was watching me. He was spending a couple days with me to make sure he was going to promote somebody this young into a role that he wasn't going to, shoot himself in the foot by doing that, right? And so he was watching me. I was running around in this big, large office doing everything. I remember him walking over to me, grabbing me by the scruff of the shirt. This is back when we wore suits. He pulled me into the corner and he said, "Stand in this corner and don't say a thing." In fact, he put another word in there. I won't put it onto your podcast. He said, "Don't say an effing thing. Just no. Nothing. Stand there. I want you to stand there. I'll come get you when I'm done." He didn't come get me for like 10 minutes. Now, for a type A guy like me, 10 minutes of not doing anything, my head almost exploded.
Yeah.
But what I did is I started watching everything. And he told me that. He goes, "Watch. Don't speak. Watch. Just stand there and watch." And so I sat there and I watched the entire office for 10 minutes. It was really hard. He came back, he grabbed me, took me in the back room. He said, "What'd you see?" And I told him like 10 different things I saw in the office. And he goes, "You will not learn what you need to learn as a leader by talking all the time, running around, fixing everything. You need to look, you need to listen, you need to be still, you need to be quiet, you need to take notes, and then you need to formulate opinions." And that was a really big leadership moment in my life, mentoring moment in my life. And I've learned to do that. A lot of times people will ask me on important meetings, "Dennis, why were you so quiet?" You probably wouldn't gather that from this podcast, but why were you so quiet? And it's because I was absorbing and really trying to understand what was the dynamic of what's being presented.
I love that. And I talk about that with folks that I've coached, and I've noticed it. Listening is a superpower. People just don't get listened to a lot.
Yep. Yeah, my mom used to scream at me all the time, "Your ears don't work when your mouth is moving that fast."
So how about books that you would, have impacted you or that you would recommend?
Yeah, it's funny because I beat up books. I have, I wish I could take this and
turn it around.
And show you. Yeah, like I have a few over here that are important to me. There's probably, there's maybe 15 there that out of all the ones, I always ruin them. I ruin all my books that I had in college. So right. You know how when you had college books, then you go sell them back.
Right.
I would buy the book for $300 and be able to sell it back for like $8 because I had highlighted everything, put notes all over it. My mom would always be so upset because I do that stuff. I still do that.
We've got four different highlighters over here with different colors. So I'm guilty.
Right now, a big one for me recently is EOS Life. Mm-hmm. And I've been living the EOS Life. We got a little bit of that here at the company. I had a little bit of it before, but got a lot of it here at the company. And I've learned a lot about just organization and really the things that we need to do to plan to have a good year, like structural things, which is great. Like I said, I've become continue to become more and more structured in my career as I've gotten to the latter part of it. And EOS takes it to like a whole nother level. It makes you think about things differently, which is really, really good. And then I don't know if I have my favorite over there, Good to Great.
Yeah.
And it's right now, Good to Great is such a great one because if you haven't read it, read it. It's pretty easy to read. But it talks about, you know, all the great companies were really formed during the toughest of times for the industry, which is really cool because Movement Mortgage was founded during the mortgage meltdown. So in 08, when everybody else was on the implode-o-meter and heading out to pasture or running for the mountains, that's when Movement Mortgage was born in the fire. And really over the last couple of years, as we've gone through some very, very tough years, we've had explosive growth at this company. And again, one of the reasons why I brought my group here, because I knew that was coming. And so I truly believe that, you know, companies that have great foresight, they build during these times. It's costly. It can be a little bit of a risk, but boy, the talent is residing out on the street during these times. And if you can bring the talent in, I don't care what industry you're in, you have the best people, you have the best company. It seems so simple, but it's not. You have the best processes, tech, all that stuff. If you don't have good people, you just won't win. And the reverse is true. You cannot have great tech. You cannot have great product processes. But if you got really good people, you'll do well. Good to Great has a lot of that in there. So there's a couple there.
Love that. So this is going to be a different question. It wasn't on the possible question list I sent you. But after learning a little bit.
Thanks.
After I learned a little about you, I thought I'd throw it out there. We may or may not end on this, depending on how you react to this, but here's my thoughts. We're both dads. Your son's how old now?
My son's 30.
30 years old. Okay. So, and we both kind of play that role to other folks as coaches and mentors with other people that we've got out there. You know, the world's a little bit scary for kids right now. So, you know, put your kind of dad hat on, and if you could, like, put yourself back in the role of, let's say, having a teenager. What would you tell them right now about the world and about success for the future?
Well, I do have a teenager too. So I had my son, first marriage, right? And then I've been with my current girl 10 years. Okay. And her son is 14. And it's funny because he same things that my son loved. In fact, they're very close, the two of them. Same things though that my son was interested. He was interested in basketball. Video games, Legos. It's almost like they're almost identical in kind of their trajectory. So it's like Groundhog Day for me, right? And so, you know, what I now is, you know, I was having to be a mentor, but older, right? You know, having the focus to into sports for kids. And if it isn't sports, it's something where you're not just solo, but you're part of a group. And what you do or you don't do affects others. I think that is a really great lesson for kids to have and for parents to have with kids. So a lot of, you know, what I talk about is how, you know, he fits into his basketball team, how he fits into his friend structure and the impacts he makes there, right? Because, you know, as a leader, I always want, you know, my kids to be leaders. I always want them. And you don't have to be necessarily a boss or to be a leader. Leaders are many times peers. It's just how you react to things, right? And be a good human, like empathy and grace. My New Year's resolution, not this year, but last year, was to have more grace. Woo! That was a hard one for me. Grace seems like it's so easy. It's not. Because when you need to have more grace is at the times when you want to choke somebody out.
Right.
And so those two things don't intersect well. So I've been trying to kind of share that as well in, you know, my teachings and my mentorings. You know, I think that's a super important thing for kids right now. You know, these, when I look at the world, and I was just another one last night, these school shootings, there was just one that was averted just literally here locally. You know, these kids, they just, the anger, like the lack of that grace and empathy, and just how do you deal with all of these feelings, right? It seems like as a kid growing up, around me, I had three friends around me commit suicide, right? And suicide was a real thing. From about 13 through college, I was in Utah, and suicide rates are very, very high, highest in the country. And so there was a lot of that around me. It seems like that now has kind of shifted a little bit, and you're seeing, I don't say less suicide, it's still out there, less teen pregnancy. Now you're starting to see kids react in different ways to the pressures that society has, these shootings, these things that are like the things that happen on social media, how they lash out on social media. It's just a different way of kind of dealing with the pressures that these kids have and trying to alleviate that and be a good dad and a good mentor. Takes a chunk of my time in the things that I talk about and how I approach life. And then I just try to be a good example. I have friends over all the time. I show them how important friends are. I show them how important it is to be happy every day. Even when the challenging situations are there, how you react to those things, they watch you all the time. When you don't think your kids are watching you is probably when they're watching you the most. Yeah. And, that's your time to really be a parent.
I appreciate what you'd said about what your boss told you to go sit in the corner and just don't say anything and listen for 10 minutes. I think we need to imagine that's what our kids are doing, because they are at that part. So I'm going to throw one more at you. And it's kind of something that probably is good for us as a company, good for you as a leader. But it also, you've been doing this a lot. I haven't interviewed people that have been doing this for 36 years. You're probably one of the most senior guys that I've interviewed. So you can compare and contrast a little bit of how loan officers have changed and how the industry's changed. And then you also can say, this is not that much different there. What are like two or three things that you see that are similar, that keep on happening, that keep people from going forward? That if it's maybe a newer loan officer here, or somebody that's seasoned, that's kind of lived the same year over and over again. And what's something you can do? It's like, if you would really just do these two or three things, that's going to get you on. You may not be on a path to doing $100 million, but you're going to be able to be really solid loan officer and provide for your family. You can just do these two or three things.
Yeah, let me start with what I think is the thing that holds people back the most, right? The glass ceiling. And that hasn't changed since 1988 to now.
Love that.
And so there's this trade-off. I believe you have skill and then you have will. You have these two things, right? And every once in a while, you get somebody who has tremendous skill and tremendous will, and they're your $100 million producers. But what normally happens is people start out in any sales profession, including ours, with no skill. So what they're doing is they're selling themselves, they're selling the ability to get whatever. For us, it's getting a home and the American dream. And they sound like this, and people start buying from them. And then what happens is over time, their skill starts to increase. And they either start trading skill for will, so they don't work as hard, or they start to lose that enthusiasm towards the human element of their sale, and they start to put in numbers. And in our world, that means they start to care about, who has the lowest rate a lot of times, or what the product is. And so that trade-off between those two things starts to occur, and they create a glass ceiling. Many times for LOs, it's right about 10 or 15 million. Then there's another glass ceiling at about 50 million. And once you get up to like that 50 million, you, in order to get to 100 million, you have to figure out how you're going to run your business and do what you do great and allow others to do what they do great and let go. Let Jesus take the wheel. And right. in this world, it's, let the support take the wheel, and you do the things that bring in the relationships and bring in the volume. That, like getting to 100 million, that 50 to 100 million, you have to completely let go of that wheel, because you cannot mother $100 million worth of business through the system. It just does not work. You might be able to do it for a year, but you will crash eventually, right?
Right.
So I think that, like, that piece of it is I've watched that happen throughout time. It doesn't seem like much has changed that. The other thing that I think now is, that has changed, though, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. is when I started in the business, especially on the mortgage side of the equation, the clients came in through the realtor. And you build relationships with the realtor, and then you would become a part of that, you know, transaction, right? That has shifted. Every year it shifts more. And now clients are coming in through the lender. And there's a lot of reasons why. A lot of that is they're shopping online. And a lot of it is social media. A lot of it is you're just finding ways to aggregate leads that now you became the port of entry, not the realtor. And that shift, I think, is a very dynamic shift. And it's something that the better loan officers today, this was not 10 years ago, or for sure not 20 years ago, they're learning how to aggregate leads through these methodologies and then own the client and then build relationships through the owning of the client. It's almost like the roles have reversed. I was just mentoring on this, in fact, yesterday with one of my people. Those roles have reversed. And if you don't identify that, and if you don't, you know, do things that will build your business from those reversed roles, you're going to miss out. You're going to miss out now, and it's only going to get worse for you in following years. So you've got to become a marketeer versus a salesperson. So when somebody else is giving you a lead, you are literally a salesperson because you have to define your worth to right. the realtor and to the client.
Right.
But when you're aggregating leads, you're a marketer. So. Right. How do you aggregate? So that's where the world, I think, has changed a lot. And where I'm having to reinvent myself is, you know, being able to bring people into that like mental, you know, space and train of thought that how do I do that? And I have a couple of people that do it really well. And they've been great lead examples for me. And I think the other thing that is unique right now, the loan officers have to really understand is the width of products that we gotta have in a market like this. This is a crazy market. And you know, we're doing commercial loans, we're doing mixed use loans, we're doing bridge loans, everything that I used to refer out to somebody, I always had a guy or a gal that did these, right? I'm now the guy. And so like that width of being able to do any kind of loan in our industry right now is a big fundamental shift. Mm-hmm. And you're either with it or you're not. And if you're not,
both know like 50% of the business kind of went away. Either 38% of the transactions last year in residential were cash transactions, 38%. And it's like, that's a big number. That's 38% of the business I can't get. They're paying cash.
Yeah, they're paying cash. And if you don't want to reinvent yourself in this market, as tough as it is this last year, if you don't want to reinvent yourself, then you're going to become a dinosaur, right? And last year was kind of like an ice age. It did define out a lot of people out of our business. I haven't seen the numbers yet. I was trying to gather those numbers actually this week for another meeting as to how many LOs did not renew licenses. NMLS does not have the data out yet. But we believe we're probably about 35-40% of the LOs that we had 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So two-thirds or little
in line with what I've heard. I just haven't seen a documented source, but I've been in line with, I think I heard 180 and now we've got 90,000 or something like that. So
yeah, it's an interesting number, right? They have it from years past. You can get it from NMLS on their website. They're the ones who would have it, right? Because they're renewing the licenses now.
Right.
But it did start at over 300. And you know, when 2020-21 happened, that number went up by 400%, but not the unique numbers. What it was LOs getting licenses in other states.
Right.
That number went way up. Yeah. But then the unique licenses are the ones you have to look at. And that's now down in the hundreds. And I'm just waiting to see what that looks like.
Pans out. So I'm going to finish with a softball. What are you looking forward to the most this year?
You know, strangely, it's not rates coming down. I think there's only a few people that I know of that were happy to hear that the Fed is going to delay their easing of the rates for a lot of reasons, right? And I'm not an economist. I try and keep up as much as everybody else does. But for me, it's not rates coming down. For me, it's having the extra time with the rates being up. Which I believe will probably 2 or 3 quarters. And having that extra time to work with my people on builder, on reverse, on non-QM, on how to build relationships and sell in this environment operates, right? So you have to be a very sophisticated loan officer to be able to sell a $2 or $3 million mortgage in today's world, because that payment at 8% is astronomical. Teaching and having them adopt all these kind of sophisticated ways of doing the business. For me, the thing I look forward to the most this year is having more time to do that. And so my hope is with the people that I support, they're going to continue to grow and learn. Because when rates come down, there's no growth going on. You're just rocking and rolling, refinancing everybody that you made loans to in the last 3 years. The mental kind of goes out and the physical comes in. I'm loving the mental part of the game right now and being able to really be a real mentor versus just a physical coach that I will be when refis come around. So that's what I'm looking forward to the most this year. And it's happening right now. So I'm happy every day.
Love it. Dennis, I appreciate your time, man. It's been great to get to know you a little bit better, your leadership style, and just about a little bit about you personally, and then throwing you the unexpected question out there. I love how you dealt with that as a dad. You know, one of the podcasts I was listening to yesterday, he said, you know, part of what I do is selfish because I'm asking questions I want answers to myself. So I appreciate you doing that with us, Dennis.
Of course, man. It's a great time today.